Hi, welcome to the fourth episode of the Steph's Place podcasts. Today I'm doing an interview with Julie Miller. What we're doing here is a kind of meet the team for Steph's Place. And Julie is a long time member of the team. So welcome, Julie.
Hi, Vicky.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yes.
Very good. So it's nice to finally get to do a podcast with you. I know we've kind of spoken about this before. Let's start just with, you know, a little bit about your history. You know, and I know you used to work in the military. You were in the army. Could you just give us a bit of history around your army life?
Yes, I joined the army in 1985. Went to Royal Military Academy Sandhurst and was commissioned by Her Majesty the Queen. I hold the Queen's commission, and I left 4 years ago in the rank of major. So I had 25 years, which is great, although it was always tempered by my gender identity issues.
Yeah.
I mean, I started being aware of my gender identity issues when I was about 12, 13. I started to wear my mother's and sister's dresses. But in those days, you know, if you got caught wearing such items, you were sectioned under the Mental Health Act and placed in what was effectively known as a lunatic asylum.
Yes, indeed.
Something or other. So when I joined the army in the 80s, I kept those feelings in a dark, distant compartment at the back of my brain and only revealed my true identity to close friends,
yeah,
which wasn't many. But if I had revealed them to the army, I would have been thrown out on mental health grounds, as were many trans people back then.
Yeah, so there really wasn't much help back in those days, was there? In the 80s,
not until
70s.
Yeah. I mean, probably about 2010 was when army policy changed and they produced a transgender management document written by a friend of mine, Stephanie, Hannah Graf.
Yeah.
Friends' names mixed up, Hannah Graf. And and since then, coming out as trans in the army has been so much easier. And so that's what I did in my last 2 weeks in the army in 2018. I came out as trans. And but in 2016, I was diagnosed with gender dysphoria at a gender identity clinic, the Laurels in Exeter. And I was recommended to live as a woman for the rest of my life for the sake of my good mental health.
Yeah.
And that's when and then in 2018, I revealed that diagnosis to the army.
So when you were working in the army, at the time, and I've heard this from quite a few people who, you know, are gay, and the message I kind of get is that the rules only apply to gay people in the army or in the military, I sometimes get the feeling that they're trying to say that it didn't also apply to transgender people. So were transgender people treated differently?
Yes, in that you could come out and be LG or B before you come out as trans. The trans policy in the army came after the LGB policy, but I don't have that intimate knowledge of the processes at the time. As I said, I just pushed it to the dark recesses of my mind. I wasn't involved in the politics, and it's only when I came out myself that I did my homework. The army is obviously a very macho culture, very masculine, and anybody who showed any other traits besides strong masculinity.
Yes.
In my case, I was bullied. I had 7 months off on sick leave because one of my fellow officers decided that to take advantage of the fact that I had femininity, and he played upon that. It's complicated and it's messy. And that's one reason why I left. I left before my contract ran out, and I did so I could be fully my gender expressive self without any worry about being bullied by people in my colleagues and people around me.
So whether you were, you know, gay or trans in the army, I guess the outcome was the same.
The thing about army policy is that it's fantastic in the barracks, where military law is applied and military discipline can be applied if people broke military law. But once you're outside the barracks, you can still mix with the same people, and they will be they might be abusive. And I had a trans friend in the barracks. She was treated with all courtesy, respect, and dignity required of army policy by all her colleagues. But when she went to the supermarket, she came out and she found her car had been keyed and the word effing tranny inscribed on it.
Yeah.
And that was obviously by a soldier who didn't agree with all this transgender stuff.
Yeah.
They've read about.
Yeah. And what were you? What was your role in the army? You were an engineer?
I was an engineer. I was a chartered engineer, a professional engineer, and I had various roles. For example, I was responsible for the maintenance policy for the army's tank fleet, Chieftain and Challenger. And that took me to Jordan, where I met King of Jordan and his wife twice. And it also, I was an audit officer auditing the repair of Challenger tanks for a good 7 or 8 years. I was also a training officer. And the best job I did, which I can't talk about, is that I was in the Army's Defence Intelligence staff.
Okay.
In Whitehall, London. And that's all I can say about that job.
That sounds interesting too.
It was the best job in the world. And I wish I could tell you about it. But if I did, then...
No, let's not get in trouble.
Men in dark suits coming to my
house. We don't need dark suits arriving, do we? So you retired from the Army. You live in Dorset, is that correct?
Indeed, I do.
And you've worked in the past with an organisation called Chrysalis, which I believe became Beyond Reflections.
Yeah. So when I left the Army, I wanted to do something with trans people in a voluntary capacity. And I joined Chrysalis and I became their local area manager for where I live in Dorset. And I set up a support group and facilitated that. One night we'd have 5 or 10 trans people all going through various stages of their transition, some suicidal and some very much in the closet. And I did that for 2 or 3 years until we had this nasty bug started going around, which we now have. And then all the support groups were shut down physically and they went online. And it was at that stage I realized that I wanted to pursue other trans-related interests, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Yeah.
There's only 24 hours in a day, so the one that I gave up was working with Chrysalis.
So what does Chrysalis actually do? I know they've got renamed, but what is their kind of core function?
Their core function is to provide emotional support to trans people and people who are gender diverse. And they set up 4 or 5 physical support groups in places like Portsmouth, Southampton, Basingstoke. And they, at any one time, would be giving, and still, I say would, still, give support to over 100 trans people, gender diverse people. And they have support groups where you sit and talk to other trans people about your issues. And then they have one-to-one counselling with a professionally trained British Association for Counsellors and Physiotherapists. Did I say physiotherapists? it's a fantastic... And the point is that there's not... The financial outlay by the members is very small. I think they have to pay £10 and that's it. So they get a fantastic facility without, and a lot of trans people, because of the nature, the fact they can't get a job because they're trans, so they haven't got much money. So Chrysalis is a fantastic resource.
So it's a free resource where you can show up and join in.
And actually it saves lives. I mean, in my support group, I've had people come through and, you know, they literally have been on the edge of death through depression and suicidal ideation.
And you were the area coordinator.
Yeah.
Are you still involved with the organization?
Not really. No. I've got too many thumbs in too many pies.
Yeah. So you've also got your own website, which I shall give you a plug, juliamiller.me.uk. And you use that website to do trans awareness talks and various things. Do you just want to explain what that's about?
Well, when I came out as trans in 2018 to my children, my daughter happened to be the LGBT liaison officer at Winchester University. And she was really great. She said, "Oh, Dad, you're trans. That's fantastic. No problem with that. Will you come and give a presentation to our conference?" And there was a conference at Winchester University, about 100 people, all to do with gender diversity. And I gave a one-hour presentation, which I drummed up. And I got very positive feedback. People said, "That was fantastic. You should do this for a living." And that's what I started doing. And I started doing presentations to local hospitals, local prisons, charities. And so it was unpaid, mostly. And also giving consultancy advice to the local councils. And the business, I then developed the website. With a good friend of mine who's a web developer, and she helped me with that.
I think we should give her a plug too.
Anne, the lovely Anne. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, she's one of my bestest friends.
Yeah.
And we've been on a journey together. So Anne, who's also helping Steph with the website.
Yeah. Yeah.
And since then, I've gone semi-professional. I've been signed up by two agencies. One of which works closely with the NHS, and that agency employs me to give transgender awareness presentations to hospitals and universities all on the South Coast, from anywhere from London to Devon, through East Sussex, West Sussex, Wiltshire, Oxfordshire. And I do transgender awareness presentations, but I also do actor role playing, where I take the role of a trans woman who has an ailment. So one day I'll have a broken leg, another day I might have a heart attack. In fact, in some days I might have at least 4 or 5 heart attacks.
And you survived. Wow.
And after lunch I might have a bit of asthma. And the next one the best one I do is with the paramedics. Because they have to do what they call their OSCEs, their observed structured clinical examinations. These are the exams all doctors and nurses to qualify, OSCEs. And I just have to lie there. I just have to lie on this couch and get prodded by paramedics.
And what's the purpose of doing this as a trans one?
Two things. One is that I'm doing it. Well, I'm doing it just as a patient. But the most important thing is that the doctors and the nurses have to treat me with dignity and respect. And they also have to treat me biologically. Now, I have biological male features.
Yeah.
I have a prostate. And so they have to, if I say I've got...
If it was in an emergency situation, you may be unconscious.
You
may not realize that.
In that situation, the policy in any hospital is that you don't care about the gender or the sex of the individual.
Yeah.
Treat the ailment. So if they're bleeding, if they've had a heart attack, it doesn't matter whether they've got, you just treat the heart attack. You treat the bleeding. You treat the fact they're not responsive.
Yeah.
But after, I think it's about 4 hours, the clinicians must make a decision on how they're going to treat you and knowing you're a trans person. And then they have to ask questions. And they have to make a decision on which ward you go into.
Yeah.
And I tell them, and they ask me, I do a lot of training with nurses, first, second, third year nurses. And one of the questions I get all the time is, if a trans person comes into my surgery, what do I do? Panic, 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 or what? And I have a checklist that I run through with them. Rule number one, rule number two, rule number three, to make them feel comfortable in treating. And all nurses and doctors, they are fantastic people. They are, if I hadn't joined the army, on reflection, I would have joined the NHS, because the ethos of the NHS is just wonderful. They treat everybody with care, not just patients, but each other.
Yeah.
So they must treat all patients with care, with dignity and respect. And that's what I teach them for trans people. I can go into detail on that, but that's what I do with the hospital.
So it's really around training nurses, doctors into, how to do this in a respectful way.
Yeah. I mean, one role I play, which is the most intriguing, I have to play a trans woman with rectal bleeding.
Good grief.
And I'm glad you laughed, because that's what all the doctors do as well. We have a great laugh.
Yeah, I'm not sure why I'm laughing. It doesn't sound very funny. But.
Well, they have to respect the fact that I present as a woman, but I do, as a responsible patient, I have to tell them that I've got a prostate. Because if I go with stomach pains, tell them I haven't got a prostate, then I send them down a different diagnostic path.
Yeah, so it's the clinical decisions are made on what you tell them.
Yeah, so and then they have to, ask me to go and do tests on myself in the loo. We all have a good laugh. But...
Hope you get paid for this, Julie.
I know.
is this voluntary, or do you actually get paid?
I'll get paid.
Oh, yeah. Good. I was going to say, like, these sound like serious things they're asking you to do if you're not paying you.
Yeah. Another role play, I have to go in with a subdural hemorrhage. I'm a trans woman who can't remember a thing. Because that's what happens when you have bleeding on the brain.
I mean, I'm really curious. How did you get into doing that?
Interesting. I got it through Chrysalis, to be honest. I went to their first conference 4 years ago now, I suppose. And there was a stand set up by the agency who does actor role playing. And I said, what do you do? And they told me, and they said, come and join up, sign up, because we need diversity. We need a trans woman. At the moment, they just got hairy blokes with beards playing a trans woman. And they were very convincing. So they saw me and they liked my, so they signed me up.
And you're also involved as a facilitator with trans support groups within prisons?
Yes. Yeah, so I've been to about three or four prisons where I've given presentations, but one in particular, I look after their transgender prisons.
Yeah.
Of which at any one time, there's only about three or four. There's some...
Is this male prisons you're going to, or female prisons, or both?
Okay, it is... all male, and for one reason and one reason only, which is that they are all sex offenders.
Okay.
All 600 of the lovelies. They are all the most heinous criminals in the country. They are the rapists, the paedophiles.
So is that the unit that you specifically...
No, this is the whole prison.
Okay.
The whole prison is...
Oh, the whole prison, all the prisoners in that particular facility are sex offenders.
Are sex offenders, yeah. Right. And people say, Julie, why on earth do you go to a prison full of sex offenders and give support to convicted rapists? And I say, well, the reason is because most of them will be released at some stage, not all, but some, but most of them. And we don't want them to reoffend. And the point about transgender prisoners is that they'll come out and they'll want to live their lives in their gender identity, which they feel most comfortable. And I personally don't want them to reoffend, so I give them emotional support. But some of those prisoners are only there because of the society that has sent them there. And I'll tell you a story. I won't mention any names. One prisoner, when she was 6 years old, she was a little boy, she started to wear her mother's skirts. And for that, her dad beat her to a pulp most weeks. Every time, like most trans people, male to female, you were born as identify as a boy and expected to live as a boy. But when you start wearing skirts, dresses, and presenting your feminine side, In this case, this person was beaten to a pulp. And by the time she got about 12 years old, she was fed up with being beaten to a pulp for wearing skirts. So she burnt the house down. She set fire to a whole house and was put into jail in youth custody for about 5 years for arson. And during that time, she met loads of criminals who taught her how to be a professional criminal. And then when she was released, she went into a life of crime, mostly burglary. And then she burgled a house. And also, and she was on drugs as well. She went into a life of drugs. And she was sent to prison for about 15 years because during one burglary, she sexually abused the person in the house, the woman. And so she was convicted of a sex offense and went to jail. And she was released after 15 years with me giving her emotional support. Now, you have to ask the question, would that person have committed that heinous crime by burglary, going on drugs, and then committing a sexual offense if that person wasn't beaten to a pulp as a six-year-old by her dad because she was wearing a skirt? And the answer is, no. If she was in a more trans-accepting society, like we are living in today, more accepting than before, if her dad had said, I see you like wearing skirts, my son, then that's fine. If that's what makes you feel happy, then you can wear a skirt. And I'll talk to the school and let them wear a skirt at school. And if you want to go to the next step and live as a girl and change your name, then that's fine. Now, if that person's dad had said that to the six-year-old, that six-year-old wouldn't have burnt the house down by the time she got to 12. And that's, that is why I get really angry when I see all these gender critical people condemning someone who's born into a male body from presenting themselves as a woman, because what they're doing is looking after their good mental health and being a positive member of society rather than going down a life of crime. And as we know, Vicky, in places like Brazil and Thailand, many trans girls, they go into a life of prostitution because that's all that's available to them because of the trans public society. And then that gets them into drugs, and that gets them into the criminal underworld. And there was that study done in Sweden, which showed that a lot of people who transitioned from male to female still had male pattern violence. Well, that's not the whole story. The fact is they went into a life of crime and they became prostitutes and they had to defend themselves when they were repeatedly beaten up in dark alleys. So no wonder they retained male pattern violence. They had to defend themselves from being killed. So that study, which is repeatedly used by Turks in their various submissions to Parliament, is totally incorrectly used by them.
So you touched on the issue of your upbringing, your background, where those people who end up in those situations kind of came from, how they ended up there. So your work as a facilitator in these prisons, obviously, you're providing support for people who are probably coming out as trans or transitioning. Do you also find that in certain cases it's used as a kind of a currency within the prison system?
Yes. Now, the big issue here is that there are genuinely transgender prisoners. They are all male, and for all their life, they have not been comfortable with that male biology. And they are genuine and they need to transition and live as women.
Whether they're a criminal or not.
Yeah. I mean, just on a general, without going into specifics, there are also highly manipulative sex offenders who see a route. I mean, they are in that jail because they have abused young boys, abused girls, they've raped women. And that is the driving force. They have this sexual energy that drives them to commit crimes and to abuse other people. And to get to that sexual fix, they have to go through the process of violence. So they have to violently attack someone to have their sexual fix. And they will do anything. And so they're very clever, they're manipulative. And when I go to the jail, I get a piece of paper which I have to read, which tells me that I am about to be manipulated by a prisoner, and be wary. And some of them will very cleverly do a lot of research and know what it is to be trans, and they will pretend to be trans. And they will convince, in the prisons, there's something called a transgender case board or complex case board, which is a group of prison staff and psychologists who have to review trans people and decide on how they should be treated, and indeed whether they should be allowed to go into the female prisons. And those transgender case boards have to, you know, these manipulative prisoners, they can sometimes be so clever that they will pull the wool over the eyes of these trained psychologists and prison officers. And then they get put into the female estate and cause havoc. And the next thing, we're all reading about it on the Daily Mail, one page of the Daily Mail or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, that is a failure. If a trans prisoner who is manipulative and isn't actually trans in the first place, just a someone acting.
So basically, they're abusing the system.
They're abusing the system, and there's a failure in the system that allows them to go through into the female estate. And so when people complain about trans women going to the female estate and raping women, I can categorically say that that person was not trans in the first place. They were just a manipulative sex offender who decided to pretend.
So how do you differentiate between the ones that are manipulating the system to get the benefits of abusing the system from someone who is genuinely trans? I mean, I understand that, you know, within the trans community, within any community, you're always going to get a criminal element.
Yeah.
So, you know, there will be genuine trans people who are criminals, who are in prison.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So how do you kind of identify, okay, this is a genuine trans person who's got themselves in prison for whatever reason, who maybe needs to go and be put in the other prison, you know, compared to someone who's abusing the system?
Yeah. The only people who can really do this properly are well-qualified, hugely experienced psychologists and psychiatrists who have got a wealth of experience and can... I mean, there's lots of clues. If you look on the International Classification of Diseases, Edition 11, definition of gender dysphoria, they list all these things that a trans person must have: a persistent anxiety about being trans from the age of whatever, 4, 5, 6 years. And one of the big problems is that there's not many trans people around. There's less than 1% of us. So, you know, there are very few experienced psychologists who've got that in-depth knowledge and background who can really identify a genuine trans person from someone who's masquerading as one.
And do you get involved in those decision-making processes?
I do get invited onto the transgender case board.
And you're also governor of a hospital.
Yeah, Governor of Hampshire Hospitals Foundation Trust. I'm on their website, so... I've been one for 3 years, and I give advice to Hampshire hospitals on trans issues, and I do presentations for there, for example, LGBT History Month, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But most importantly, I'm just a governor. I'm just another governor. Nothing to do with the fact. So I sit on Zoom calls like this with another 10 or 15 governors and directors and chief executives of the Hospital Trust. And I give my thoughts as a governor on how the hospital is running, on the issues that they're up against. And the point is that by the nature of being a governor, most governors are middle-aged and well-qualified. I've got to be careful here. People that you would expect traditionally to become governors. And I'm a trans person, and there's not many trans governors, but they don't take the trans issues, you know, they just see through anything. I'm just...
No, you're just a governor. You're not a governor because you're trans, are you?
No, I'm just a governor because I'm interested in helping the hospital
yeah.
more efficiently.
So you're not there for any specific reason related to transgender patients?
No. Yeah. No.
But yeah, another fascinating thing that you do.
Yeah.
So let's get on to Steph's Place. And I know you were kind of one of the founders of Steph's Place.
Yeah, Steph set up Steph's Place, I think it was in 2020, around about the first lockdown, because she was so angry. She was a political person, member of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
And she was so angry about all the misinformation that was being put out by all these gender critical people. She decided she wanted to do something about it. She set up her website and I started following it on Twitter. And then we interacted a bit, and then she looked at my website and realized that I was quite active within the trans community in terms of all the stuff that I've done. And she invited me to become a co-editor.
Yeah.
And there's about four co-editors. Mm-hmm. And I was invited to be one. And I started writing articles. The most interesting one I wrote was on toilets.
Oh, yes. The other famous trans issue.
And I look back at the history of toilets going back to about 16 something or other, and then through to the suffragette movement, which brought in ladies' toilets many years after men's toilets were brought in. And, concluded that that toilets have been around for 100 years, and anybody can walk into them. And has there been an issue with trans women going into the ladies' loos? No, not one single complaint over 100 years. So what are they kicking up a song and dance about? They've got no evidence whatsoever that it has ever been a problem. Anyway, that's one article, but
yeah.
Five or six articles. But the trouble is my transgender business interests were growing. And I was running out of hours in the day. So I'm not a co-editor, but I'm a member of the outer circle. And literally last night, I was up until midnight reviewing an article that Steph asked me to review on transgender healthcare. So I'm still active. And as you know, I make the occasional comments on the WhatsApp group.
You do indeed.
And I gave some advice just recently on how to submit complaints to the police in order to get it looked at in a timely manner. So yeah, I'm still involved in the margins, but not as a co-editor.
Yeah, and as Steph's Place has developed, you know, there was four co-authors of editors originally. It's expanded into, you know, doing podcasts now.
Yeah,
and one or two others have joined in as well. So yeah, it's become a real kind of force for the good, hasn't it?
What Steph has done is fantastic, because she's got the ear of politicians and members of the House of Lords. And the thing about Steph is that she is extremely diplomatic. So she will have her views on trans issues, and she will listen to gender critical views, and she will respond, but in a very respectful of other people's views. And that gets her respect throughout the community and throughout the political institutions as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why she...
not an easy thing to do.
Sorry?
That's not an easy thing to do, that.
It's not. And as you know, it's very easy to get very angry very quickly. But yeah. Bites the tongue. And
it can affect your mental health, having to deal with those things on a, you know, on a regular basis.
Yeah. I mean, I've... You look on Twitter and you see the abuse that Steph gets.
Oh, yeah.
From people who come from a place of mostly ignorance and bigotry, because they just really haven't bothered to read into what it all really means. They don't understand the concept of looking after your good health. They don't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand the concept of the word gender, where it came from. And they don't understand the difference between sex and gender. And so they come at Steph from a position of ignorance and fire off all this abuse. And Steph just bats it off in a very respectful and dignified way. It's great.
And it was really nice last Friday, you know, to be at the National Diversity Awards, where Steph's Place won an award. And Steph's was amazing.
It was fantastic. She was
the only person of the whole evening who got a standing ovation. So, yeah. You know, in a room full of, you know, cis women, cis men, you know, to get that kind of response and that kind of support was amazing. And
it just goes to show that these gender critical people say, we are fighting for women, we are the voice of women, all this is absolute rubbish, because as you saw at the NDA Awards, half the audience that stood up were cis women. They just didn't sit there with their hands
crossed. There was a huge applause. Everybody was standing up. It was,
and when I give my actor
role, moment.
Yeah, when I do my nurse training, the first question I ask, and most nurses are female, the first question I ask is, how many of you know a trans person? Over half of them put up their hands. And I say, do any of you know a gender critical person? No one put up their hands.
No, I mean, I've never really come across one.
No. And
they're very vocal online, and they're very vocal in certain areas. But
they're only vocal online because that's the only outlet where they can express their views, where they're hiding behind some daft pseudonym for a start.
Yeah.
Like Posey Parker. And where they know they can't get called out. But in the place of work, the place of education, they cannot express their unpleasant views. That's why they are so vocal online. But when you talk to people, I talk to the nurses and I explain to them what gender critical means. And they say, really? And they say, that is disgusting. I'm ashamed to be part of this gender identity we know as women, if that's what other women are like. They don't want anything to do with this gender critical. So gender critical people do not represent women. And they have no evidence. You look at their websites, you look at Fair Play for Women, you look at Sex Matters, you look at all these other websites. They don't tell you how many people support them. They're very narcissistic and they support each other. But you can look at other charities, for example, Women's Institute, for example, and they will tell you that they have got hundreds of thousands of members and they're mostly women. Statistics. But you look at these other websites and you look at LGB Alliance, we know that they've got a few thousand members, of which 7% are actually LGB and the rest are not. So, you know, these people do not support women and they have no evidence.
And it's getting quite worrying how some of these organizations, like some of the stuff that Posey Parker does, you know, it has ties into far right groups.
Absolutely. And
we can see that from what happened at Brighton. You know, earlier
they even admit it amongst themselves now.
You admit it. I mean,
tweet where they actually admitted that they're attracting far right fascist movements.
Yeah, and these people are showing up at their
you
know, their rallies that they've organized. I mean, that is you know, not a good sign, is it? Yeah.
Well, you say that's not a good sign.
Well, I mean, it's not a good sign for them that they're involved.
Oh yeah, no, it's not a good sign for them.
You know,
but you know,
it shows you the truth behind it.
Yeah. One reason why these groups have cropped up, they're trying to portray themselves as representing women, but they are simply a backlash. This is just my opinion. But trans people have come from under the radar of society through the early part of this century by means of internet. Trans people have come out and they have brought with them a language which people don't like, the use of pronouns and other terminology that wasn't around 20 years ago, non-binary, genderqueer, These people are a backlash to a hugely successful wave of trans people who have come up from the radar of society into the full glare of the sunlit liberal democratic society.
Yeah.
And there is a backlash. But that backlash is by a very tiny... When I was in the army and we did military training maneuvers, we used to describe moving across the North German plain, tens of thousands of NATO soldiers. I was one of them. And coming and defeating the Russians coming the other way, obviously a very topical topic. And we used to describe that we defeated the main army of the Russians, but we had to deal with small elements of enemy resistance, pockets of enemy resistance, just sweep them up. Deal with them in the noise. And that's what these gender critical people are. They are small pockets of enemy resistance because the main culture that we're dealing with, the great liberal Western democratic society, has now accepted us, trans people. Politicians use this word trans person in parliament. Newspapers have articles where they use the word trans person. That didn't happen 25 years ago. You had transsexual and transvestite. That was it. And they were regarded as people with mental illnesses they had to sort out by dressing up in women's clothes. Now we are so respected that we are talked about with respect in Parliament and by the great and the good. And so we have, as an element of society, trans people, we have won the cultural war, but there are pockets, small pockets of enemy resistance that call themselves gender critical people, or TERFs, or whatever they want to use today or tomorrow. They are a minority that have that are vocal. And this is what happens when you have small people. They bark loudly, like when you back an animal into the corner and it is afraid. It will make a lot of noise. And that's what we are dealing with. A small group of people are making a lot of noise. And the greater good, that is most people in society, have accepted that trans people should be treated with dignity and respect and be just a normal part of that great mosaic that we call life.
Indeed. Is there anything else that your, projects you're involved with, things you'd like to talk about?
I just become a motorcycle instructor.
No, really?
Yesterday, I got my certificate. So I can now be a trans woman giving instruction. Now, the problem here is that I've got a male physique. I've got big shoulders, 6 foot tall. I've got an Adam's apple. I've got a voice which is not very feminine. And so I've got to wear PPE on motorcycles, which is armor-plated leather jackets and helmets. So I need to try and make myself look really feminine, but on a motorcycle. That's not easy. So that's my next challenge.
Oh, get yourself a pink helmet.
Exactly. My wife said, I said that to my wife. She said, no, you don't do pink. He said, you need a purple helmet.
I think what you need is a trans flag, colours, letters. That's what you need.
A trans bike.
Trans bike. There you go.
I'm trying to imagine what that looks like.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Julie. We've covered a lot of topics there. Thanks so much for coming on and having a chat.
It's my pleasure, Ricky, and I hope what I said has an impact.
Yeah, I think as we move forward and Steph's place evolves, there's so much great work they're doing. It's only going to get better.
I agree. Yeah. And there's going to be some changes, Steph's place in shortly, and going to get better and going to attract even more interest.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, I'll sign us off there. It's really nice talking to you.
Okay, Vicky.
Anybody who's listening, please go look at Julie's website. And once again, it was juliemiller.me.uk. And if you want to get some motorbike lessons, Julie's your girl. Bye for now.